Retired coal miners have been waiting for months for a life and death decision from Congress, and now they have it.
Before we got this news, my phone was being burned up. I mean, I had people calling me every day. What are we going to do, you know?
I'm Nova Safo, health insurance and Illinois coal miners. That story coming up. Also, police officers making art.
I see a lot of people get shot. I've seen a lot of people take their last breath. Just taking the brush to a canvas helps me process that.
We visit an exhibition at a Chicago police station. And we also take a look at the citizenship process for Illinois immigrants and talk presidential libraries. They've got a few secrets that will surprise you. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nova Safo, filling in for Nyla Boodoo. For months, retired coal miners in Illinois and across the nation have been anxiously waiting to find out if they'll continue to have access to health insurance. Congress needed to act, and the clock was ticking. And finally, last week, they got their answer. In a few minutes, we'll hear from a union rep for the miners. But first, we go to Duri Buscarin, a reporter for St. Louis Public Radio, who's been following the story. Hi, Duri. Welcome to the 21st.
Thanks for having me.
So what's the latest with the coal miners and their health insurance?
So the bill that Congress passed to basically keep the government open until the end of the fiscal year includes a long-term fix. Basically, these coal miners belong to a union that administers a health insurance program, and they used to work for coal companies that have now gone bankrupt and no longer are required to pay into the fund for their health benefits. So they were going to lose their health insurance at the end of the month, and that's now been extended for at least 10 years, and it looks like it'll be paid for through money from the Abandoned Mine Reclamation Fund. It's basically fees and investment income that currently operating coal companies pay in.
Why is the money coming that way instead of from the coal companies where these miners worked?
So basically, U.S. bankruptcy law guarantees some private pension funds, but it does not guarantee health care. So the companies pay into the healthcare funds as they're operating, but if they go bankrupt, they're released from that obligation after they pay a few, you know, bankruptcy settlement payments. So because the coal industry and coal unions have so few workers now, the number of people paying into the fund, to the pension fund at least, is about, you know, a tenth of the number of people receiving benefits. So that's going to become insolvent, and the health benefits were pretty much going to run out.
Now, I understand this issue with the health benefits for retired coal miners affected some 22,000 people and their families, and this is a life and death issue for them. Can you help us understand what they've been going through in terms of waiting and how long they've been waiting to find out whether their health insurance would be extended?
Sure. So, I mean, the first time I went out to Southern Illinois to talk to these guys was November. And they were looking at losing, they had already gotten warnings from their insurance plan that they were going to lose their coverage at the end of the year. That was extended for 4 months until April, and then that was extended for another week until the, you know, long-term plan kind of came in and Congress agreed to it. But there was a really long time in there where these former coworkers and their families weren't really sure if they would continue having the coverage that they've been having. It's pretty good coverage. It's coverage that they negotiated over decades and would take maybe like lower pay in order to guarantee their health care, because even back then they knew that coal mining is a really physical job that takes a toll on your body and on your lungs, and they now, most of them, have chronic health issues. They've gone through surgery. And their medication, which may not necessarily be covered by Medicare, is something that they get through their insurance, and they rely on their insurance to pay for it.
So now the extension goes for another 10 years, is that right?
So that's actually something we're trying to nail down right now. It's been reported both ways. It's either politicians will say it's a permanent fix, other coverage says it's 10 years. The Congressional Budget Office scores it on a 10-year basis. And so we know that it's at least paid for by 10 years. basically, it'll cost about $1.3 billion for 10 years. And after that, we're not totally sure.
Now, since the U.S. government is involved, the Congressional Budget Office is scoring it, $1.3 billion over 10 years. Is this a bailout?
Well, I mean, I think that the union would not agree with that language, but essentially, yeah, the coal companies that are now bankrupt no longer have to pay for these benefits that they promised these guys decades ago, and the abandoned mine reclamation fund money is now paying for it. It's related to the coal industry. It's user fees and customs fees that the coal companies are paying, but it's, yeah, I mean, it's government money, and I think that that's why there was some opposition to this in Congress, because it was kind of a, well, if we bail out this industry, then what about, you know, everyone else? Why are we picking this union over others?
And even though, you know, there's money involved and there's talks about whether government should pay for it or not, we're talking about people's lives, aren't we? I know you've been to union meetings where this issue was being discussed while it was still in limbo. Can you tell us what it was like being in that room, what the feeling in that room was?
I think that there's a lot of frustration. There's a feeling of being let down by these companies that these workers had worked for decades. There's a sadness that this industry has seen so many bankruptcies and so many fewer jobs. I think that different people will put the blame in different places. I think that there's some anger towards the Obama administration or EPA regulations, but, I mean, coal really started declining under the Bush administration. So it's unclear where the blame goes. And, you know, maybe the blame goes to the fact that the industry didn't innovate fast enough and didn't go to renewables fast enough. But I think that at the end of the day, these people were promised by their union and by their company that they would have health care until they died, and that their families would be taken care of, and that they would have a pension. And now that's suddenly not reliable anymore. And I think that that leads to a lot of frustration and anger and despondency.
Yeah. All right. Jury Buscarin of St. Louis Public Radio, thank you so much for spending a few minutes with us.
Hey, thank you.
In a few minutes, we're going to be joined by Judy Hogue, representative of the United Mine Workers of America. But first, to learn more about the health issues that are commonly faced by coal miners, I'm joined now by Dr. Andy Yoakum. He's the osteopathic program director at the SIU Family Medicine Residency Program in Carbondale. Dr. Yoakum, welcome to the 21st.
Well, thank you for having me.
And what are some of these common health issues that coal miners tend to face?
They will have what we call a shortness of breath, dyspnea. They will also have some chronic mucus production. With the shortness of breath, it can affect their quality of life. The important thing, though, is these coal miners, the initial diagnosis is made by taking a good occupational history and then doing a chest x-ray, but they may initially be symptomatic free, and so they've been working in the coal mines for several years and not realize that their lungs are becoming affected. And so it is important for any coal miner to get established with their primary doctor so that they can get set up and examined and have their screening appropriately.
And what is the actual damage that's done to the body and to the lungs?
Black lung is categorized as an interstitial lung disease, meaning that it affects the gas exchanging tissues of the lungs. What happens when the coal miners breathe in the coal dust, the dust settles into the lung tissue. And over time, it can become fibrotic, meaning you can get scarring of the gas exchange system. And so collectively, black lung is called what we call a pneumoconiosis, which literally means dusty lung. And it starts with just the simple pneumoconiosis, mm-hmm. and then it can progress to complex, which is termed the massive pulmonary fibrosis.
And how expensive is treatment, and is it a lifetime of treatment? Is there curing? How does this work?
Sure. So, like most other coniosis, there is no curative treatment barring a lung transplant. And so, as family physicians and doctors in general, is more of a supportive therapy. So it could start with just simple steroid inhalers. If the condition is severe enough, then they can we can do oral steroids, oral prednisone. And then obviously some of these individuals do become oxygen dependent. And so that's what we're dealing with. With insurances, it's sometimes hard to get medications approved. And so it's a pretty rigorous process at times to try to get the inhalers, because sometimes they may be on two or three different type of inhalers, and then of course oxygen, whether it's just 24/7.
It just seems like a very
continuous oxygen.
It seems like it really takes over their lives, and it's quite debilitating. I'd like to bring in Jody Hoag now with United Mine Workers of America. She is also a retired coal miner, formerly with Peabody and Kincaid. Jody, had you lost this health coverage, how would your life have been affected?
Well, actually, I didn't have the health care because I didn't have enough years. However, I'm the president of a local, and I have over 300 members, and probably between my members and their families, we had about 600 people and that are in my local that are going to be affected by this. But this health care law, this was the health care was promised to us back during World War II, or right before it was finished, if we would work and produce the coal, that the government promised that we would have cradle-to-grave health care and pensions. So it's not that we're asking for a giveaway. It's the fact that we were promised that.
Were you surprised, were your members surprised to find out that when the companies you worked for went bankrupt, all of a sudden your health care was in jeopardy?
Yes, because we thought that that was a promise that they would keep. And my members had all worked for Peabody Coal Company. Actually, my family had all worked for Peabody Coal Company. I had my father, my brother, and five uncles that all worked for Peabody Coal Company. And, you know, it was just something that we thought was promised and a promise that would be kept.
And how have your members been reacting, your family been reacting, finding out that now at least for 10 years, maybe longer, you will have this health insurance? I imagine there's some relief there, but can you tell me how you guys have been reacting?
Definitely there is relief. Before we got this news, my phone was being burned up. I mean, I had people calling me every day. What are we going to do, you know? So my phones have calmed down, but everybody is really... They're rather surprised that we got the bill through because we've tried for 5 years, but they're all really happy. And now I've had several of them call me and say, well, now I can go ahead and have this surgery the doctor wanted to do because I wasn't going to do it if I thought I was losing my insurance.
How taxing has this been, this kind of waiting process for you and your members?
It's been very taxing. You know, I have a few widows that call me, and they don't understand. They get these letters that, by law, they had to send the letters out when their insurance was going to be dropped. So when they get the letters, they don't understand it, and it's been really hard on them.
All right. Jody Hoag, thank you so much for spending a few minutes with us, the president of the United Mine Workers of America Local 9819 and a resident in Taylorville. And, of course, Dr. Andy Yoakum, osteopathic program director at SIU Family Medicine Residency Program in Carbondale. Thank you both so much for your time.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And you're listening to The 21st. All this week, the Chicago Police Department is putting on an exhibit of artworks created by its officers. The idea is to showcase their talents and to show how officers deal with the challenges of their job. I visited the exhibit at its opening last weekend and spoke with some of those presenting their artworks. Take a listen.
My name is Sean Lochran. I'm the commander of the 20th District of the Chicago Police Department. Where we're standing right now is the community room of the 20th District. We've temporarily reconstructed it into an art gallery. We presently have 56 pieces, individual pieces. The most common representation is photography, and then we have oil on canvas, charcoal drawings, stained glass. We have some steel sculpture, ironworks.
My name is Dan Sako. I worked for the Chicago Police Department for 30 years. I retired out of organized crime 2 years ago. Picked up my passion, putting out good, nice steel art.
Were you surprised to find out there were so many other police officers creating visual art?
When I walked in this door, I was shocked. There are so many artistic policemen.
Name's David Alcazar. I'm with Unit 102. I have three paintings.
What do you think you get as an officer out of expressing yourself through art?
Relief, outlet, escape. Because sometimes you can't talk or write, talk to people, because as much as you try, they can't get in your head. You know? I can't get in your heart. So it's very therapeutic.
My name is Antoinette Alcazar. I've been with the Chicago Police Department for 11 years. I have five pieces on display today.
Tell me about which would be your favorite here.
This one right here. It's titled Overwhelmed.
So basically, it's a woman sitting in almost a fetal position.
Correct.
She's blue. She's covering her eyes. What were you trying to say?
I was trying to depict the intensity of that emotion of being overwhelmed. You know, I see a lot of people get shot. I've seen a lot of people take their last breath. And sometimes just having to process that in your mind, I noticed that walking into my studio, turning on some music, and just taking the brush to a canvas helps me process that.
What my greatest hope, my greatest takeaway is the public sees that we're not just police officers per se, not just the common representation of a police officer is as an authoritarian, where there is a problem solver, some sort of crisis. This shows, and my hope is the public sees that there's additional dimensions of police officers is conveyed here.
The voice of Sean Loughran there, commander of the 20th District of the Chicago Police Department, where an exhibit of officers' artworks is on display through this weekend. I'm Nova Safo. This is the 21st.
The 21st is made possible by the Library at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, supporting librarianship and the training of librarians, instructing instructors as they embed the library into classrooms and beyond the campus across the globe. The University Library at Illinois.
And you're listening to The 21st. I'm Nova Safo, filling in for Nyla Boodoo. A quick update now on the firing of FBI Director James Comey. Today, Illinois Attorney General Lisa Madigan and 19 other state attorneys general sent a letter to the Department of Justice asking for the appointment of an independent special counsel to investigate Russia's meddling into the presidential election. Many Democrats are calling for the same thing today, saying Comey's firing tainted the FBI's investigation. The White House is rejecting such calls. Yesterday, we had U.S. Senator Tammy Duckworth on, and she said many of her constituents in Illinois want an independent investigation. Lots of you have been responding to that interview, and we wanted to read some of your comments. Christy on Twitter says Duckworth is right. Another commenter said he definitely wanted Trump and any potential ties to Russia investigated, adding, quote, "I don't see why every American doesn't. This is serious and dangerous." And Debbie on Twitter said an independent probe would, quote, "protect all players and sides, ensuring a fair outcome." Thanks to everyone who chimed in on social media. Keep the comments and questions coming on Twitter. Our handle is @21stshow, and you can write us on Facebook. Search for The 21st. Immigration is one of those hot-button issues right now in this country, and we're likely to see more controversy surrounding the issue over the next few years as the Trump administration hashes out how it wants to reshape immigration laws. But do you know how immigration has already shaped Illinois? Here's a statistic for you. 1 in 7 people in the state are immigrants. And based on the last census, immigrants account for big portions of the population gains in certainly Chicago, but also Bloomington, Champaign, Kankakee, Peoria, and Rockford. And half of all immigrants are already naturalized citizens. So we thought it would be a good idea to better understand the process of citizenship, something many immigrants here in Illinois will go through at one point or another. And just to have a little fun along the way, we're going to test your knowledge of American civics by asking you some of the questions that appear on the citizenship test. See if you can answer them. We're joined now on the phone by Sunita Singh. She's a doctor in Chicago and became a U.S. citizen on April 24th of this year. Dr. Singh, welcome to you and also congratulations.
Oh, thank you for having me.
All right. And Dr. Singh, you and your family were naturalized together, I understand, just a few weeks ago. Can you tell us what he was like?
It was a very emotional and uplifting experience, which came at the end of a long wait of almost 16 years. And we were very fortunate that we were able to do it as a family, because originally we had all got different days and times. So my daughter, who is an attorney, was able to get Magistrate Mary Rowland, who is from the Northern District of Illinois, for to preside over the ceremony and have us sworn in front of family and friends, which was, it was a very special experience.
You just called it emotional and uplifting. Why are you using those adjectives?
You know, this was something that we've been working for the past 16 years, and it wasn't always a given that, you know, even though we jumped through all the hoops, that, you know, this would eventually happen. So that itself was a, you know, very rewarding experience. And uplifting, because now we were actual citizens of the country that we have lived in and Maui that we call our home, and we are able to vote and, you know, have a voice, opinion, and just generally be heard now that we're citizens.
Yeah, the process can take different lengths depending on who you are, where you came from, what your particular circumstances were. But generally about 5 years of permanent residency and then you can apply for citizenship. But can you tell me just about how long the actual naturalization process took for you from the from that first application on?
So ours naturalization process started through the visa that we came to work in the U.S. on, and that was a H-1B visa, and that entitled us to work here in the U.S., and at the same time, after 6 years, a visa lasts for 6 years, you become, or you're allowed to apply for the green card.
The permanent residency.
Yes, the permanent resident card. So we did that, and that took a couple of years for that to come through, and then you have to be a permanent resident for 5 years before you're allowed to, you know, go through the final naturalization process.
So the years really do add up.
Yes, they do.
Yeah, yeah, indeed. And how much does it cost to become a citizen? It's there are significant fees involved, aren't there?
Yes. You know, there's, for us, it was lawyers' fees, plus because they did the green card application, and that came to almost, I would say, maybe 1,000 per person, and then the lawyer's fees were separate. And then the actual citizen application, I think it was around $700 for each person.
And so it really does add up. And what about the test itself? You know, there's, of course, now a civics test as part of the citizenship naturalization process. Do you remember your test and what it was like?
Yes. So it's actually there's a bank of 100 questions that we have to go through, and they actually ask us 10 of those questions, and we have to answer 6 correctly. And some of them are geography questions, and then there's some history questions also. For instance, they ask me, you know, who wrote the Declaration of Independence, and then what were named 3 original states in the United States, and then geography, like what state borders, or name one state which borders Canada, or, you know, Mexico.
Right. So these aren't all very obvious questions, at least not all of them. And we wanted to see how we promised our audience we'd test them a little bit here. And so if you're studying for the citizenship test, there is a CD, audio CD you could get, this kind of a preparatory CD where a voice asks the question and then gives you the answer and kind of gives you a chance to repeat the answers and learn the questions. And so we have some of the audio from that CD, and it's also available as MP3. And we're going to play one of those questions and see how our audience does. You guys have about 2 seconds after we play the question to see if you can answer it. Here's the first question.
The idea of self-government is in the first 3 words of the Constitution. What are these words?
Dr. Singh, I don't want to put you on the spot, but I'm sure you know the answer. You just studied for this.
Right, we the people.
We the people, that's right. I wanted to ask you, aside from the fact that it took a long time to get here, why was it so important for you and your family to go through this process to become citizens? What does that mean for you?
You know, my story actually starts much earlier than coming to the States for the first time, and it was mainly because my family left India when we were young, and I grew up in Saudi Arabia in a Arabian oil company community. And so everything around us was American, and that influenced me to, you know, really work towards coming and living in the U.S., you know, at some point. And, you know, for instance, you're sitting in the middle of the desert, but you have Betty Crocker in the kitchen, you're watching Marcus Welby, MD on TV, and you have, you know, you're ordering your furniture from, you know, Montgomery Ward or Sears, et cetera. So, you know, that sort of influenced our desire to, you know, further that dream and come to the U.S. and work. So we had to do a bunch of exams because we were already physicians, but when you want to train here in the U.S., you have to redo everything. So we had to write about 5 different tests and then apply for the visa. And a lot of it was also for our children. We wanted them to, you know, benefit from the higher education here in the U.S. and just life in general here.
Well, I wanted to thank you so much for spending a few minutes with us and sharing your story. Thank you so much for coming on today.
Oh, you're welcome.
That's
Dr.
Sunita Singh of Chicago and newly minted U.S. citizen. We're now joined on the line by Mary Catherine Roberson. She's a citizenship instructor at Danville Area Community College. She also teaches English as a second language. Ms. Roberson, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And we're also joined by Paula Winke, Associate Professor of Second Language Studies at Michigan State University. Ms. Winke, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
Mary Catherine, let me start with you. How many of the answers to the citizenship test did you know before you started teaching the class?
Well, I studied political science as a major in college, so I probably had a bit of a head start on, on the 100 questions. So I knew probably about 3/4 of them. I didn't remember all of them, though.
All right. And we're going to go to another question here. We're going to do, again, these are preparatory questions asked to prepare for a citizenship test. Let's hit that next question.
How many amendments does the Constitution have?
All right, Mary Catherine Roberson, to you for the answer.
That is 27.
27, that's right. Now, I confess, I didn't know the answer to that one until earlier this morning. So tell me about the background of your students and the process of teaching them to prepare for citizenship.
Well, as the doctor mentioned previously, there is a bank of questions. So even in my ESL class, we started going over them 5 or 10 at a time because everyone isn't eligible for citizenship that's in my ESL class, but they like to learn about the history and the culture. So we try to break it down as small as possible to make it to feel like a doable feat. So we practice the questions and also the history, and we do some interviews, oral interviews back and forth using that information. We also play games with the information, just different methods to try to help them memorize it because it's a lot of information, and we learn it over our whole life and our whole high school career, and they will have to learn it, some of them, in a short period of time.
And with English being a second language, how tough a hill is that to climb?
Oh my goodness. It's a difficult hill. And we have a multi-level class. So we're teaching concepts at several different levels simultaneously. But everybody is very patient with each other and with me. So, and they're really eager to learn. So that I think is what drives all of them to, you know, to be willing to persevere, even though it is a big hill.
Yeah. Professor Winky, to you now, how effective do you think this citizenship test is, the gauntlet we put immigrants through?
Well, I think it's an interesting question. It seems to me that it's just one of the small pebbles along the road to citizenship, and the citizenship being the mountain. Mm-hmm. And Ms. Robertson was right that learning English is a big hill along the way. Mm-hmm. And all of these things take so much time. So Dr. St. Fine talked about her long wait and how emotional it is. It's a long road. But the little pebble of the civics test that exists during the naturalization process is something that you don't want to stub your toe on, because you must get past it to be able to get citizenship. So it's a very small test. It's an achievement test, but it has enormous consequences, not just for the test taker, but for the test taker's family and future generations as well of that person who's taking that test. So in that sense, it's a nice little test, but we need to look at it critically because of its major importance.
And are there aspects of this test that we need to rethink?
There are. We've looked at the test here in the Second Language Studies program at Michigan State. In particular, we've looked at an alignment of the questions and how difficult they are. Because like Ms. Robertson, we teach a civics class here in Lansing, and that class needed some direction on which questions are going to be most difficult for the students to learn. And in doing that analysis, we found that there's different levels of difficulty. Some of them you just have to memorize. We call them the technical questions, like the one you asked, how many amendments does the Constitution uh-huh. have, or when was the Constitution written, all the way down to common knowledge ones, like what is the President of the United States, which I think you don't even need to be a U.S. citizen. You could just be anywhere in the world, and you most likely know that one. So we found that some of the items work really well, that they seem to separate out the knowledge base that citizens have compared to non-citizens who have not yet studied. And those questions that work really well are ones that seem to be about local government. So some of the questions that we found that are helpful in the learning process and that native speakers of English who are good citizens, they tend to know, is what's the name of the Speaker of the House of Representatives now, or who is your state's senator, what's the governor of your state, when do you have to register for selective service if you're a man. And these are things that you really have to learn if you're coming to the United States, because you won't know these answers, and you won't know them until you are participating in the government.
And Ms. Roberson, are there questions that you're teaching your students that makes you scratch your head, or they scratch their heads going, why are we being even asked this, or are they pretty much self-evident?
Well, it's interesting that you just mentioned the selective services one, because that has given us quite a bit of a pause in my class when we talk about it, because it's something that they're not familiar with. So then we have to talk about like the draft and why we would need a selective service and when has a draft been used. So some of these concepts, they build onto other concepts, so you end up in kind of a quagmire of unfamiliar concepts. And so that's where I said patience and perseverance comes in, because, you know, often something that would be an easy question for me to answer for you requires quite a bit of backstory for my students.
All right. We're going to end the segment with one more question, one that I thought was actually really difficult. Hit it.
The Federalist Papers supported the passage of the U.S. Constitution. Name one of the writers.
All right. Now, we're going to let our audience take a second here, and we're going to give them a hint. Here it is.
Just two words.
Alexander Hamilton. Alexander.
All right. Well, if you don't know, that's the music from the hit Broadway musical Hamilton. And the answer for one of the writers is, of course, Alexander Hamilton. There are three others, but we're going to have to leave it at that. Mary Catherine Roberson, citizenship instructor at Danville Area Community College, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. We appreciate it.
And Professor Winky as well. Paula Winky, associate professor at Michigan State University. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And you're listening to The 21st.
It'll never be the same.
with him.
Me, I died for him.
Me,
I trusted him.
Me, I loved him.
And me, I'm the damn fool that shot him.
There's a million things I haven't done.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
And you're listening to The 21st. I'm Nova Safo in for Nyla Boodoo today. We now know what the Obama Presidential Library in Chicago is going to look like. The big reveal came last week. We also know the former president's hopes for his library to be not just a testament to his 8 years in the White House, but a vibrant place that trains future generations of leaders and a place that helps revitalize Chicago's South Side, the very neighborhoods, of course, where Obama first got into politics and where he and First Lady Michelle Obama still have a home. Here's a sample of what the former president had to say last week.
Our belief is that if we do this well, not only will this end up being a world-recognized institution where people from not just around Chicago, not just around the country, but from around the world come to teach and learn and work with each other. But it's also going to be a transformational project for this community. That it can bring economic development opportunities to this community.
All right, Obama went on to say that the project will reshape and revamp Jackson Park, the historic landmark where the library will be placed. All of this is supposed to spark economic revitalization, as the president mentioned, and create hundreds, if not thousands, of new jobs. Our next two guests have heard all of this before. They've both researched presidential libraries extensively, and they're going to help us understand whether Obama's goals can actually become reality. Joining us are Anthony Clark, author of the book The Last Campaign, How Presidents Rewrite History, Run for Posterity, and Enshrine Their Legacies, and Benjamin Hofbauer of the University of Louisville, author of the book Presidential Temples. Gentlemen, welcome to both of you.
Nice to be here.
All right, Mr. Hofbauer. Let's start with you. Do you think Obama will succeed in getting his library to be an economic engine for the South Side of Chicago?
I think he probably will. I think there'll be a lot of people who want to contribute to the Obama Library, and so I think they'll probably meet their fundraising goals. And the big thing that struck me about the president's announcement is that the place sounds like it could be fun. You know, they talked about sledding, lectures, concerts, making movies, making music. Those are all things that you don't really associate typically with the presidential
library.
He
also said there'll be basketball there, which,
yeah,
if you know the president, that's kind of important.
Excellent, yes.
And now, Mr. Clark, I think you might have a slightly different view. What are your thoughts? Will Obama succeed in economically redeveloping the area through his library?
Well, I agree with my friend Ben that he has a greater potential than any other presidential library has. I think the only unequivocally successful economic engine in the presidential library system was the Clinton Library. Every other library has really not created a kind of a booming economy around them. And I think the reason why the Obama Library has a chance is that it's not going to be a traditional presidential library. The records won't be there. Researchers won't be coming to look at the documents of the Obama presidential administration. And the museum will be operated by the private Obama Foundation, not the National Archives.
All right. So, yeah, we're going to get to how the library is different. But I wanted to kind of get back to what you just said about the libraries have had really mixed success. There's 14 other presidential libraries right now. And Mr. Hofbauer, I wanted to ask you about the economic impact and the history of these other libraries. They've had mixed success. They've not all been huge boons to the cities where they've been located, right?
Yes, that's true, and I agree with Anthony. The great example of a presidential library that sparked an economic boom is the Clinton Library in Little Rock, Arkansas, Most of the others, I think, do have a modest positive impact, but they usually tend to overstate them when they're selling them. But I agree with Anthony that, you know, this one, because of its location, because of President Obama's celebrity, because of the different functions he has in mind for this presidential center, not really a library, I think it might well sparks considerable economic development in that area.
But the numbers, again, also with the Obama Library, at least initially, have been kind of on the high side, something like 800,000 visitors a year, one of the projections. Do you think it'll actually get to those kinds of numbers and spark that kind of revitalization?
That's a good question. It might, but that is beyond what any presidential library currently draws. I mean, the Reagan Library, I think, is the most popular, and Anthony may be able to give me a more accurate figure, but I think it's around 500,000 for that. So mm-hmm. It's suggesting it will leapfrog beyond that. But Chicago is a huge city, and Obama's celebrity and popularity are pretty much unprecedented. And so I think there's a chance, at least in the initial years, that it could draw that many people.
Anthony Clark, a lot of times we get these kinds of projections with presidential libraries. They're going to bring in hundreds of thousands of tourists from the outside of the city to the city. They're going to spark all this economic development. Do they always attract so many outside tourists and become a tourism magnet?
They do in the initial years when there's the kind of the bloom is still on the rose, if you will. And so that first initial 12, 18 months might see as many as 400, 450,000 visitors at the most recent libraries. But the reason why I think the Obama Center will be different, and we're doing a lot of agreeing, Ben, this is mm-hmm. great, the center isn't having those community functions as an afterthought like the other presidential libraries. I mean, you could go to wine tastings and square dance lessons and kids movie nights at some of the libraries.
Okay, where's the square dance lessons? I have to ask.
The square dance lessons were held at the George H.W. Bush Library in College Station, Texas, a few years ago.
That's really interesting. I would have gone to that. before we go on, I wanted to ask you guys, you mentioned also earlier that the Clinton Library has been an outlier. It's really had a level of economic boom, added economic boom to Little Rock, Arkansas, where it's based, at a level much higher than other libraries. It's really sparked redevelopment. And I'm wondering which one of you wants to tackle this. Maybe Mr. Clark, why has the Clinton Library been such an outlier?
Well, I think the first part of it was the site selection. I mean, they found a derelict warehouse area along the river just past the end of a once popular Main Street. And so they created the Presidential Center. They drew in the University of Arkansas. Heifer International moved there on the same grounds. And then as people started coming in, that street that kind of led from the main area of Little Rock down towards the Presidential Center started building. A hotel came back, restaurants. The Clinton gift shop is not on the library grounds initially. It was actually along that street. And so they made a really good decision in the site selection to draw people in.
And
I'm not sure that...
Go ahead.
Go ahead. I said I'm not sure that necessarily will have the same impact in, let's say, a really rural area like West Branch, Iowa, or an already heavily populated area like downtown Chicago.
And what about the Truman Library in Independence, Missouri?
Oh, well, Ben is an expert in that. I'm going to defer to him.
Mr. Hofbauer, take it up.
Well, the Truman Library opened in Independence, Missouri, a small city outside of Kansas City, in 1957. And it's been, a small little engine of economic growth for a small city. So I think it's had a small but modest economic impact, positive, for decades now in Independence. However, as Anthony mentioned, that in the beginning years of a presidential center, they tend to have huge attendance at the beginning, and then that slowly tapers off. So for the Truman Library, for instance, in the 1970s, they typically get about 300,000 visitors. Today, it's more like 100,000. So that economic impact in time obviously diminishes.
Now, both of you agree on one other thing, and that is you've both been very critical of the 14 presidential libraries that exist now. Ben, I'm going to put you on the spot here because I'm going to quote you. You wrote recently, and this is a quote, that the libraries are surreal in their megalomaniacal self-promotion.
Yes.
Want to explain yourself there?
Well, it's really hard to believe. Like, for instance, if you go to the George W. Bush Center in Dallas, Texas, a huge, you know, until the Obama Library, the most expensive presidential library ever, they've got bronze statues of the president's dogs. They've got a video game that you can play being president. But if you decide, for instance, in this George W. Bush presidential library game that you don't want to invade Iraq, former President Bush himself comes on the video monitor and says, no, that's not correct. You must invade Iraq. That's anything else is not correct. And that's just what the tip of the iceberg in terms of these places enshrining presidents' egos. I mean, you have to have a healthy ego to run for and be president. But these places display that in a way that's kind of surreal. And I think Anthony can add some delicious details to all that.
Mr. Clark, I know you probably have a ton to say about that. And I want to also ask you about funding. I know you've criticized how these libraries are funded and run. Can you explain what your concerns are there?
Sure. So the president creates a foundation, a private foundation, to raise the money to find the location and build and equip the library according to standards that the National Archives sets. But then traditionally, up until the Obama Center, the foundation would then donate it in some manner, either through lease or through deed, to the National Archives, and the government is responsible for operating and maintaining them. But the foundation still gets to write the content of the exhibits. So you have a situation where you have a museum with the seal of approval of the United States government and the American taxpayers, but not describing nonpartisan fact-based history, but whatever the foundation wants to say.
Hmm. And,
so
how
for example,
and how much money are we spending actually operating the 14 presidential libraries currently?
Between operation, maintenance, and capital improvements, it's approaching $100 million a year. So that's not an insignificant amount, even if though we have a very large federal budget. And that goes to providing staff to open the records for research, the archivists to review the papers, but it also provides staff to promote the museum to educators and public affairs specialists and curators and exhibit specialists, all working towards furthering the legacy of and the goals of the private organization, not the government.
And you were talking about offering some examples of how the foundation kind of leads the curation and the exhibits. Can you pick up on that example?
Well, for example, the Richard Nixon Library was run privately for 17 years, and then it came into the National Archives fold very late, the latest that any presidential library has been adopted into the National Archives. And the first thing that the new federal director did, Tim Naftali, was to dismantle the Watergate exhibit because it was, as he said, fundamentally inaccurate. It said that the Watergate was a Democratic plot to make Carl Albert, who was then Speaker of the House, President of the United States. They said there was no smoking gun. It was one of the most skewed, although after that, the Reagan Library opened and the Bush Library opened and the Clinton Library opened. And so the National Archives worked towards making it much more factually based and much more nonpartisan, and the foundation fought them tooth and nail. The foundation even tried to get Dr. Naftali fired from his job, and the National Archives tried to go along with it.
Now, I understand, Mr. Clark, I understand we're running out of time, so I wanted to get back to the Obama Library and say I understand that you are very hopeful, actually, that the Obama Library is going to break away from some of these, from this mold and lead us in a new direction in how libraries are conceived and run.
Well, sure. I mean, I don't know. I think this might be a final thing. Ben and I agree on that. I don't think it's going to be a museum that's any less celebratory or any less fact challenged than the predecessors. My happiness about it is that it won't be government run. It won't be operated by government employees, and it won't have that kind of seal of approval. And moreover,
exactly,
the National Archives won't
completely
be working in the same location.
And Mr. Hofbauer?
Yes, I agree completely with Anthony. That the big thing is, you know, having a museum of, you know, spin if it's run privately and paid for privately, you know, that's okay. That's his business. The problem with previous presidential libraries, where I agree with Anthony completely, is that they were run by the government. And so you had a government-run museum of propaganda, and that's a big problem.
All right. Our guest's Anthony Clark, author of the book on the politics and history of presidential libraries called The Last Campaign, and Benjamin Hofbauer. His book is Presidential Temples. Thank you both so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
All right. That's all the time we have for today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. We're produced by Christine Harmon and Alan Montesillo. Abrar Alhidi is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Thanks to Joe Yoon and Nick Vance from the University of Illinois' Social Media Analytics Lab for their research help. And special thanks to the band Public Access for the theme music you're listening to right now. I'm Nova Safo, and for Nyla Boodoo, The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.